you guys. Welcome back to Flickers of Fear, going back to the 1990s for this one. Now, I've been a big fan of Guillermo del Toro since the first film of his that I saw, which was either The Devil's Backbone, which came out in 2001, or Pan's Labyrinth from 2006. I can't remember like which one of those I saw first, but there's just always been something about his particular vision in filmmaking, I guess. He's very into the idea of the beautiful grotesque, and he just has this sense of wonder and magic and stuff. You can tell he's really, really into horror, like he really loves it. And that really comes across in all of his stories, like even when some of them are really sad or really tragic. And he also has that thing where he also embraces the monster, embraces the outsider. And I kind of feel like a lot of the stuff that he does in his films like really resonates with me particularly. And so I've enjoyed pretty much every single one of his movies that I've seen, and I've seen pretty much, well, almost all of them. I even like his sort of bigger budget ones, even though I obviously prefer his more personal films. Now, shortly after I saw the two movies that I just mentioned, Pan's Labyrinth and The Devil's Backbone, I actually discovered Guillermo del Toro's first feature film, Kronos, which came out in 1993 and was made when he was only 29 years old. And it's like, I've seen like behind the scenes photos of it, and he for real, it just looks like a kid. It's like really, really funny. Now, at the time that I first heard of it, which was probably, I don't know, 2007, 2008, somewhere around there, I kind of feel like a lot of people weren't really talking about it. And I actually wasn't, I mean, video rental places were still a thing then, and I went to rent it and they didn't have it, like, you know, because I grew up somewhere where they didn't have like a lot of weird movies that you could rent. But I actually was able to buy a version of it online. It was like a DVD, and it was like the 10th anniversary one, so it came out in 2003. So I was able to get that, so I actually do own a copy. Now, this is actually, Kronos is actually like a fascinating movie to watch because it demonstrates pretty clearly that even at that young of an age, like a relatively young age for a filmmaker, all of the attributes that make Del Toro like one of the most beloved and esteemed filmmakers in the world, like still to this day, were already really firmly in place. Like he really had a sense of his own identity and what he wanted to put across in film. So Kronos is essentially a vampire story, but because it's Guillermo del Toro that we're talking about, he actually puts a really unique spin on this kind of like classic and maybe a little bit stale monster. And to the story, he sort of adds like a lot of his traditional kind of themes to it, which is like this kind of melancholy that a lot of his movies have. Like they're very gothic, they're very elegant, and they also usually have like a really, like a lot of heart to them, like a really good like emotional core, and they also have like a lot of dark humor to them, they tend to, and this one has all of those things, you know, in spades. So at the beginning of the movie, there's a little bit of a prologue, and we learn that there was like an alchemist named Fulcanelli, who was actually, I didn't know this, but it was based on a real guy, like a French alchemist. Like, you know, if you don't want to check out Fulcanelli, like go to the Wikipedia page like about him, and he's like really interesting. So this alchemist was living in Mexico in the 16th century. I think it was like 1563 or something, or 1530 something. Now he invents something called a Kronos device. What this is a little gold clockwork style mechanism thing. It looks kind of like a scarab, and it can actually bestow everlasting life through a method which you don't actually learn what it is until later on. So the prologue then goes on to show that this alchemist actually lived until 1937, when it so happened that there was like an earthquake in Mexico, and it toppled the building that he was living in, and it sort of caused this stray wooden beam to kind of fall on him and like pierce through his heart, which killed him. Now, his body was found in the wreckage by authorities, but the fact that the building also housed a bunch of big basins that were full of presumably human blood, that was actually never disclosed to the public. So there was this kind of like creepy, like urban legend kind of vibe about it. So we then jump ahead to December of 1996. I think it's like right after Christmas. Interestingly, and I'm not really sure what the deal with this is, but the movie is actually set 3 years after it was actually made, because it was made in 1993, but it's set at the end of 1996. And I'm not exactly sure why. I didn't know if he wanted to make it so that, it was a 400-year gap, between when the alchemist died or something like that, or when the alchemist, made the thing. I don't really know. And why 400 years? I don't really know. But anyway, it's set, in the future, which I thought was kind of strange. So there's an old man named Jesus Gris, or Grease, whatever, who's actually played by the Argentinian actor Federico Lupi, who was in a fuck ton of stuff, but he was also in Pan's Labyrinth as well. Now, he runs an antique shop in Mexico City, and he has this granddaughter named Aurora, who he's really, really, he just adores her and dotes on her all the time. Now, Aurora actually lives with Jesus and his wife, Mercedes, after her parents were killed. I don't even know if they mention in the movie, how the parents were killed, because it happened, prior to the events of the film. So she's been living with them. Now, in a recent shipment to his antique shop, Jesus has got this archangel statue, but he hasn't really completely unwrapped it yet. So, because he's got a bunch of packages in there and they're all just still in the wrappers. So after he opens the shop one morning, this very sketchy young man wanders into the shop and seems really, really interested in that in particular. And he starts pulling aside the paper from the face. And he's just acting really weird. He's going to rob the place. So because he's so particularly interested in this one item, after, Shifty McRobberpants leaves the store, Jesus decides he's going to check out this statue or whatever it is more closely. So one of the angel's eyes is broken, and so he puts it on the desk, and in a scene that absolutely made my fucking skin crawl, a bunch of cockroaches come scuttling out of the hole, which, yeah, I'm really, really grossed out by cockroaches, so that always kind of made me go, blah, because all these roaches are coming out. But yeah, so they all come out, which demonstrates to Jesus that the statue is hollow, and he kind of knocks around on it, and he hears that there's maybe something concealed in there. So he pries up the base. And Jesus and Aurora actually discover the Chronos device, underneath the base of this. But of course, they don't know what it is. They're just kind of ooh, what's this neat little thing? It's a little gold thing about, I don't know, about the size of a donut or something like that. Maybe not that big. It's actually, like I said, it's kind of a scarab size. So, Jesus is kind of amused, and he starts, tinkering around with it. And the little mechanism comes on the top and starts spinning around, and then little legs with spikes on the ends kind of shoot out the sides of this thing, and it clamps down on the palm of his hand and starts drawing a substantial amount of blood. It really does cause quite an injury. Now, of course, he can't see this, he can't see what's going on inside, but there is a really cool shot of the inside of the device that shows us, the audience, that there's actually a living insect inside, and it's kind of intertwined with all the clockwork, and it appears to be drinking the blood. Now, obviously, this insect has been alive for 400 years, 460 years, whatever it is at this point. So, I said, it was an alchemist that made it, so it's magical realism. Now, subsequently, after this happens, he gets this injury from the thing, Jesus starts to feel a little weird. Not bad, necessarily. Actually quite good. He starts to look and feel younger, his hair gets thicker, and some of his wrinkles go away, and he feels a lot more vigorous and all this other kind of stuff. So he feels he's getting a lot younger. But he's also developed a hankering for something that he can't quite put his finger on what it is. He's just seems he's thirsty all the time, and he's drinking all this water, and it's not helping, and he's awake at night, and he seems really anxious and all this other kind of stuff. So at last he figures out that it's actually the device that he wants. And much like an addict, he starts sneaking around in the middle of the night and clamping it onto himself, onto his chest and stuff like that, and kind of letting it do its thing, which I'm presuming is either drinking his blood or putting something else in his blood, or maybe it's an exchange or something like that. He also begins to develop an insatiable desire to drink blood, even in one kind of well-known scene, licking some off a bathroom floor at a New Year's Eve party after there's been a guy in there who had a nosebleed. So his granddaughter, Aurora, who we're led to think, I don't think she's necessarily mute because she can talk, but she only actually says one word in the entire film. So I don't know. I think they were trying to imply that maybe she was on the spectrum or something like that. I think the only word she says is grandfather toward the end, although I guess it'd be abuelo or whatever, because this is mostly in Spanish. There is some English, but it's mostly in Spanish. So she only says one word in the whole movie. So Aurora, though, is like actually worried about what's happening to him. And as it turns out, the Kronos device transforming her beloved grandfather into a vampire, essentially, isn't really the only concern that she should probably have. Because, you see, there is also in town this wealthy businessman whose name is Dieter De La Guardia. Now, he's actually played by Claudio Brook, who was in a fuck ton of movies. But I had seen him in, he was in The Devil's Reign from 1975 with, you know, William Shatner. And he was also in the 1989 James Bond movie, License to Kill. So he was in that as well. So he plays this businessman. And he's dying from some wasting, I'm presuming it's cancer or something like that. And he is actually in possession of a book that was written by the alchemist Fulcanelli, and it has all the stuff about the Kronos device in it, like how he made it and how it works and all this other kind of stuff. So he's actually spent the last few years scouring the globe, essentially, to find the Kronos device so that he can live forever. And he knows that it's in the statue, like he knows what the statue that it was hidden in like looks like, but he doesn't know where exactly it is, because there are a lot of statues that look like that, you know what I mean? So you can see like in his office there's all the statues that he had bought that didn't have them in there, and he just has them hanging up in like plastic, like in his office or whatever. So his bruiser of a nephew, Angel, who's actually played by Ron Perlman in this, and the hilarious thing, I saw this on the IMDb trivia page, but they said that initially they wanted to get Ron Perlman to speak Spanish in the film, but after he read his lines in Spanish, Guillermo del Toro was like, yeah, don't do that. He does like say a few things in Spanish, but he says it like purposefully bad because they changed his character to be like an American who's living in Mexico and he doesn't really like it there, so he's just like being a jerk by like speaking Spanish badly, because he actually did speak Spanish badly, so they kind of wrote that into his character. But I just thought that was really funny. So yeah, so he's kind of like, Angel is basically like his uncle's enforcer. Like, he hates his uncle and he wishes his uncle would hurry up and drop dead, because he's supposed to get this big inheritance, and the only way that he will keep in the uncle's good graces is by going around and like trying to get this Kronos device. But ironically, he's also kind of in a pickle, because if he does actually find the Kronos device and give it to his uncle like his uncle wants, then he will never get the inheritance because his uncle will never die. So, like I said, he's kind of a little bit of a rage monster in this. He's definitely a bad guy, but that's kind of why, because he's like in a no-win situation. So he actually comes to the antique shop at first and buys the statue for some like princely sum of money, and not knowing that that Jesus has already taken the Kronos device out of it. So when he gets back to the uncle's office and like they go in there and they figure out that the Kronos device isn't there, and they're pretty sure that that's where it was. So then he starts like targeting Jesus and the shop, like he trashes the shop, and he's basically like, you have to come here and give us the device because we have the book, you don't know how it works, you don't know what it is, and all this other kind of stuff. So he basically like targets Jesus. So there's that whole thing going on too. So these two bad guys are also trying to get the Kronos device off of Jesus, even though at this point, like, Jesus has become essentially like addicted to the thing. Now, eventually, Angel actually ends up killing Jesus, at least he thinks he does, by pushing his car off a cliff. But because Jesus's heart wasn't pierced, because that's the only way you can kill them, he actually revives, like, while he's in the Undertaker's, like, they're just about to, they do like the thing, and then they're just about ready to cremate him, and he actually like wakes up and leaves. And this is actually one of the funniest scenes in the movie. Like, it's very black humor, but I really like that. So this is like one of the funniest things with like the two guys, like the funeral director and the assistant, I think. Now, interestingly, these two guys, and this is another little random bit of trivia, the funeral director and his assistant from this movie, actually the actors like reprise the same characters in a movie, like a Mexican movie called We Are What We Are. It's not I know there was like an American or a Canadian one or something like that that came out in 2013 that was called that I think it was about cannibals, but this is a different movie. This was like a Mexican or Spanish, at least a Spanish language film. This came out in 2010, and it's almost considered like a standalone sequel to Kronos, even though it's kind of like a different story. But those two characters repeat in that one, and I haven't seen that, but now I have to see it because I hadn't heard of it before now. So yeah, so now that Jesus is dead, but now he's like undead, obviously. His body starts to deteriorate, but Aurora, his granddaughter, loves him just the same, and she actually ends up like trying to help him like defeat Dieter and Angel. And the film ends like a little bit ambiguously, because I'm not entirely sure, like Jesus isn't really sure either, if destroying the device will kill him or will return him to normal, and you don't really know like which of those things is going to happen. So I will say that even though Kronos isn't quite as, I guess, self-assured or polished as Guillermo del Toro's later films were, which, like I said, not a big surprise, because I think it only cost $1.5 to $2 million to make, which, you know, only $2 million, but yeah, for a movie that's not much, and it was his first movie and he was like really young, but it's so it's like surprisingly assured for that, you know, for being like his first film and everything. But it's still like a really, I mean, it's an extraordinary debut, really. I mean, it's a dark fantasy, I guess. It's a horror movie, but I would call it a little bit more like on the dark fantasy end. But it does have quite a bit of gore. It's has like a really original take on the vampire mythos, as I said, and it has like a really strong emotional core at its center about, you know, the unconditional love between like Aurora, like even though like still loving her grandfather and still helping him even though he's turning into a monster, and also has some stuff to say about maybe like the poisonous lure of immortality, like what you'll give up to get that. And I will say that even though Jesus, you know, the main character, he falls victim to the Kronos device accidentally, like he doesn't know what it is. He just finds it in the bottom of things. He's like, oh, neat. And then like, you know, he essentially just gets turned into a vampire like by accident. But he ends up becoming like something of a slave to it. But he's still like sympathetic throughout the whole entire movie, even as he, you know, toward the end, like he starts struggling with his desire to like drink the blood of his granddaughter. And he's kind of like able to not do that, like because he still retains enough of his humanity. So it's really like a lot of Del Toro's films. It's very beautiful and it's very sad. And it's kind of like a tale about addiction, about, you know, the lengths people will go to maybe to get like a little bit more time than they're due, or to get like eternal life or things like that. And it also has some stuff to say, like I said, about unconditional love and how sometimes it can overcome like even like the worst evil. So, I mean, if you've enjoyed any of Guillermo del Toro's other movies but haven't got around to seeing this one, I would definitely recommend it, because it's just a really outstanding horror film, and it kind of like examines a lot of Del Toro's favorite themes and a lot of his visual touchstones. So it's really kind of interesting to see where it all started, I guess. So yeah, if you haven't seen it, you definitely should. If you have HBO Max, it's on there, but I'm sure you can find it elsewhere. I watched it on HBO Max, but I'm sure, you know, you can find it other places too. There's also a Criterion Collection version of it, like on Blu-ray. So, you know, if you want to go that route. But yeah, so that will do it for this Flickers of Fear. I will see you guys again on the next one. Bye.